Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. What's big news in the last couple of weeks for Congressman David Price? Because as I measure it, David, except for 2 years, you are celebrating the 20th anniversary sort of your first election to Congress. Was it in 1986?
86 it was. And so, yes, we're starting on year 20, except two of those years were spent back at Duke involuntarily.
in exile.
Very pleasantly, but involuntarily with the Gingrich sweep of 94. But otherwise, I've been in Congress for 9 of a possible 10 terms.
And the big news is that you're signing up again. I guess it's no surprise, but it is pretty big news for someone having served, how are we going to say this, for 18 out of the last 20 years to go back?
Well, I guess it depends on who you ask, but it's big news for me, and I hope that it'll be received well by my constituents, which include a lot of people within sound of our voices,
right.
They say. Orange, Durham, almost half of Wake County, and then a good portion of Chatham.
Well, now, you and I are about the same age, and so I can't say you're an old man, but I'm retired, and a lot of people at our age are already retired or are making, you know, the most ferocious retirement plans. Probably a lot of them are asking you questions about the Social Security, Medicare, how to count up things and how much they're going to get and how to work with the government about all this. But at the time when many of the rest of us are either enjoying or contemplating retirement, you're putting your head down and going again.
Well, you know, I am amazed at how early people retire these days. I mean, there are many, many people in our community here who have retired in their mid-50s and who have very, very active lives. It's just not what they did for most of their career. I remember going to a high school reunion over in Irwin, Tennessee, where I grew up. This might have been 10 years ago, and all these people retiring, and this was in their mid-50s. People have military careers, some civil service careers, others just want to do something different. I guess my trajectory is a little different. I had a teaching career that went for a number of years over at Duke University, taught at Yale for 4 years until 1973, then was at Duke in political science and public policy from 73 till 85. And was getting active in politics locally, and one thing led to another. Went over to be state Democratic chairman in the blockbuster race of 84. Took a year off to do that. Eventually, the tail wagged the dog. All these political involvements became a career change. So I was 45, 46 years old before I was running for Congress. And so I've now had a 20-year career, that's true, but it's still challenging to me. I think there's a lot of work yet to do. And I got my back up somewhat. I mean, I think in these conditions, that's partly what it takes. If anybody's in Congress these days, especially in the minority party, just for the honor of it, you know, you better think twice. There are other things that are a lot more relaxing than this. I mean, this is combat duty, and I try to cooperate when I can and have a good record of achievement, I think, under the circumstances. For example, in appropriations, appropriations funding for what we need to do around here, and projects like this Democracy Assistance Commission. Where we're working to strengthen parliaments in emerging democracies, that's a nice bipartisan achievement. But I have to say, it's polarized. It's very polarized. It is very, very exclusive in the sense that the House is run in such a way as to keep people like me from making a full contribution. And so I want to change it, and that's partly what's energizing me.
Well, I want to talk about some of those things, but it's interesting to me, sort of trying to watch politics objectively, and nobody gives me credit for having succeeded in that effort, But watching Congress work and watching the North Carolina legislature work, the complaints of many of you and many of your colleagues on the minority side as to the partisanship and lack of ability to really be full-scale contributors to the effort because it's been hijacked by the majority, parallel some of the complaints of Republican members of the North Carolina legislature who have the same complaints, who say the leadership just doesn't hear us or listen to us and it's totally partisan. Is this something which is just endemic to the American political system, that the minority party and the members of it are not able to contribute fully? Is that just going to be the way it is forever? Or is this something that is special to modern times?
It's a good question, and I'm not sure I'm in a position to give you a very good comparative view looking at our own state legislature, let alone others. What I do know is this, that some of this is endemic. Some of this is endemic to the House of Representatives. Historically, it's a, you know, it's a chamber of 435 people from very diverse districts. It has been a partisan place for most of its history, and it needs to be a partisan place in the sense of having two well-disciplined, well-organized parties that will engage their members and, at the end of the day, will allow the majority to rule. And you remember in our younger days that the majority didn't rule very effectively. You had a Democratic Party that was split very badly. The dominant figures in Congress were these conservative Southern committee chairs, many of them opposed to civil rights and other things, who just stayed there forever. And the Congress was not ruled by a majority party very effectively at all. It was a kind of conservative coalition often between those conservative Democrats and whatever Republicans they could pick up. And so there was every reason, I think, moral as well as political, to change that. And the Democratic Party in our lifetimes, as we were becoming as we were coming of age politically, the Democratic Party was changing a whole lot. The South was changing a whole lot with the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act. The Democratic Party became a more homogeneous party in the sense of dropping that very conservative, sometimes racist perspective, and the Southerners who began. Who were elected in modern times as Democrats don't look that different from Democrats elected elsewhere. And you made a good couple of runs yourself, and you know, you were running as a mainstream Democrat. You weren't running as some kind of regional representative. But anyway, the Democratic Party needed to shed that segregationist past, needed to become a coalition party with blacks and whites fully participating, and needed to organize the House more effectively. And that was done in the 70s and 80s. And I was part of that in the latter years of that period. I tried hard as a Democratic whip to try to get our majorities together and to organize effectively. So that's not the problem, and I don't think we should think that it is. There's nothing wrong with good, strong political parties. There is something wrong with a kind of hyper-partisanship that totally excludes the other side, and that also diminishes the institution's capacities. And what I mean by that is a partisan practice that, in my view, and this view is widely shared, has gone way beyond the normal partisan tit for tat.
What is to be done about it, if anything? What can be done?
Well, I'm part of a so-called Gang of Four that is has put forth a reform package, and we're addressing the lobbying abuses and the travel abuses, the kinds of things that the Abramoff scandal has brought to light. But we're also addressing the way the House is being run, and rules. The rules need to address this, I think, in part. We partly need new rules, and we need rules that both sides are willing to live by, no matter who's in charge. We also need, I think, just some rethinking on the part of the present leadership as to where they're going and where they're taking the institution and the country. And there's some slight hint that John Boehner, the new Republican majority leader, may be prone to some rethinking, but I don't know. I'll just give you a couple of quick examples. How can anybody think it's a good idea to have a Medicare prescription drug vote in the middle of the night, to hold that vote open for almost 3 hours until the last hapless member's arm can be twisted? That's a travesty. How can anybody think it's a good idea for the chairman of the House Senate Conference Committee on that same prescription drug bill to announce at the beginning of negotiations that if Democrats show up, the meeting will simply be adjourned? In other words, this is a conference for Republicans only. That is way, way out of line. And it goes way beyond Democratic practice when we were in charge. Mm-hmm. This is a sort of high-handed hyper-partisanship that I think you'd have to go back to the days of Czar Reed and Czar Cannon.
Do you really now? To find. We if you're on the side that that is in favor of the particular legislation that's being rammed through, you kind of condone, or you're more inclined to condone any means to get it done. You congratulate the leaders who are able to, with a persistence and force, to take advantage of every rule and every opportunity to get it through. Again, an analogy in North Carolina where the complaints from the opponents of the lottery, for instance, argued that the tactics used by the leaders, by the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate, were similar to those that you described in terms of waiting until the right moment and when people, the right people, were absent, not expecting that the vote would take place, that those kinds of things took place to secure this particular vote. Isn't it something that is always done by the those in power, that if they want something, they're just ready to just
push hard? No, I don't think so. I'm no great fan of those tactics here in this state on the lottery. For that, for the record, didn't look very good to me. Although I'm not sure why those people were absent or what kind of wink and a nod.
Yeah, well, we're at a distance to criticize.
Fair. I certainly would not say that's the way a legislative body should pass major measures. I think what you're saying is true, but only up to a point. And we need to be clear, as clear as we can possibly be, about what the limits are. I said earlier, we need disciplined parties. We need for people to understand the consequences of their action if they're part of a party team, and to be and within reasonable bounds to we need to work on them and persuade them. Yeah. And try to form that team solidarity. But I don't know. This is not necessarily as successful as I believe you're implying always. Let me give you an example. This president has less to do with members like me than any president I've served under. I came in the late years of the Reagan presidency. George Bush the first, then Bill Clinton, and now Bush the second. Bush the first and Clinton were real schmoozers with the members of Congress. We were down there all the time talking about things. Reagan, not so much, but the one who has least to do with the Congress and is least, I think, attuned to trying to work with members of Congress is the present president. I've actually been to the White House only once in 5 years to have a sit-down with him about a pending matter, and it was very early in his presidency and had to do with the fast-track trade legislation, the enabling legislation to facilitate the trade agreements. It's pretty clear, I think, to anybody who looks at it for 5 minutes, that both parties in this country have a hardcore anti-trade element. They're going to blame whatever happens in the economy on trade. They're never going to vote for trade agreements. So it's axiomatic that to pass trade agreements, you need both parties. You need some support in both
parties. You've got to have a bipartisan coalition, because it goes against what, in many districts, the popular notion
exactly.
of how things work is. And so in this respect, you could argue, particularly if you're for a policy of more open trade as strengthened in the United States, you adopt the policy that the representative's judgment is what we buy, not just following the lead of his constituency. He or she moves beyond that if he or she is going to be a leader.
Well, in a lot of constituencies like this one, there's a lot to be said for open trade policy.
It's a little easier here.
Anyway, my point is that anybody who studies it for 2 minutes knows you have to have a bipartisan majority. And yet we found this. The point of my story will be evident quickly. That we found in this administration the president was following a very partisan course. He was absolutely refusing to accommodate those of us on the Democratic side who had traditionally been pro-trade votes. But when we suggested that we should be using these trade agreements more effectively to get some leverage on labor practices, on environmental practices in these developing countries, not putting ourselves at a disadvantage, he just wouldn't hear of it. And in my 1 minute in this meeting that I'm describing, I said to him, Mr. President, this should not be a cliffhanger, this vote on fast track, and it doesn't need to be. You know, you don't want this to be a partisan victory, a very narrow victory because it sends a very bad signal with regard to these very difficult future trade agreements. If there's reasonable accommodation among the traditional pro-trade elements in the House, we can have a fast-track bill that we can agree on, and that is going to serve our country well. We have an overwhelming positive vote, and then that's a good omen for the trade agreements to follow. That was my 1 minute's worth, and of course it was totally ignored. The fast-track bill was passed with a minimum of Democratic votes. It was passed in the middle of the night, held open for an hour. The last hapless Republican's arm was twisted. In this case, it was our friend Robin Hayes from Concord. And sure enough, that spelled trouble for trade agreements, including CAFTA down the line. Now, CAFTA passed the same way. But why should our country's trade policy be handled this way? So what I'm saying to you is that it's not clear that these tactics always result
always
in the
work.
Kind of victories that you want, or that they always work. You know, the House needs a bipartisan capacity as well as a partisan capacity. And I think we've lost a lot of that, and I think the institution is the poorer as a result. In fact, I think it's quite dangerous that you can't even conceive of the kind of bipartisan work that we had on the budget and on entitlements in past years. It's quite dangerous to lose that capacity, but I think that's what's happened under the present leadership.
Well, David Price, we could talk about this for a long time, but we do need to take a break. We're talking to David Price, who's recently signed up to run for Congress again, and he's here to tell us why. David Price and I'll be right back.
Turn down the sound. Tune in to Win with News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Every time the Tar Heels are on the road, we've got the perfect place to come watch the game. It's Blue, a brand new sports lounge at the Holiday Inn on Fordham Boulevard in Chapel Hill. Come to Blue and watch the game on the big screen TV with other WCHL listeners and all your friends from News Talk 1360 WCHL. We always turn down the sound for the radio play-by-play from Woody on the Tar Heel Sports Network. During each Turn Down the Sound party, we broadcast our pregame show live from Blue.
A News Talk 1360 WCHL. Turn down the sound. Tune in to Win. Viewing party.
Join Jeff Hamlin and me, Ron Stutz, plus the two former Carolina point guards who know the score, Jimmy Black and King Rice. During timeouts, we're giving away Carolina t-shirts, WCHL coffee mugs. Plus, we'll give you the WCHL phrase that pays that you can only hear at our Turn Down the Sound party. And you can win $100 at our next morning show, courtesy of Harrington Bank. You deserve banking like this. Next Turn Down the Sound party at Blue happens next Saturday night when the Tar Heels go to Duke.
The Paris of the Piedmont, the Seattle of the South. The town of Carrboro has been a hub for artistic creativity for years, and Carr Mill has been an integral part of this vibrant community since 1977. Stop by and browse through this beautifully restored historic mill filled with locally owned shops, restaurants, and galleries. You're bound to find something your heart desires. Great restaurants, specialty shops, and galleries. Carr Mill, located in downtown Carrboro at the intersection of Weaver and Greensboro Streets.
News Talk 1360 WCHL presents D.G. Martin and special guests on Who's Talking every weeknight at 6 and 10. This is our special Sunday morning replay.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Congressman David Price, who's telling me some of the reasons that he's willing to sign up to run again, notwithstanding the fact that he has reached the age at which I find myself already retired. But David, you're an example to all of us with the energy of a teenager, and but there's more than that that I think is driving you. There are things I sense. You mentioned earlier that you got your back up about some things. What is it that you are most passionate about that is that drives you back to a Congress in which you're a part of the minority party and cannot maybe participate as fully as you might, either if the Democratic Party were in charge or if the way the House worked was a little bit different? You're signing up to go back into that kind of dreary place.
Why? Well, combat duty. Let's stress the oppositional side just for a moment. I hope it's clear I'm not out merely oppositional. I work on the Appropriations Committee, which is still reasonably bipartisan, and we get a lot of things that North Carolina needs through that process, and that's very satisfying. This Democracy Assistance Commission was a bipartisan achievement.
Well, tell us about that.
I'm hoping that my Teaching Fellows Act, getting into the teacher recruitment business, federal government supporting that, I think that can and should be bipartisan. Well, just quickly, the Democracy Assistance Commission is a it's my bill, and the Speaker, after something of a delay, decided that it was a good thing, and so fortunately we're moving ahead with it. I'm the ranking Democratic member. David Dreyer of California is the chairman, and it's an outgrowth of work we did in Eastern Europe in the early 90s, where we reached out as an institution to the emerging parliaments, gave a lot of assistance and support and some one-on-one consultation, not on our terms, but not trying to impose anything, but on their terms, on the kind of help they thought would be useful. So it was a very, very valuable thing, and one of the most rewarding experiences I've had as a member. My idea has been to renew that and to do it in a wider range of countries. So we're working at this moment in Indonesia and East Timor. There's a group of members over there right now. We're going to be in Kenya and in Macedonia and Georgia. So we're off and running with this commission.
That's great.
That's great. So there is some bipartisan hope left. But you ask about having my backup and about opposition, and there's a lot on that menu as well. I'm particularly upset over the what you might call the arrogance of power, the kind of my way or the highway attitude we get from the White House. That's not just political assertiveness. It has, I'm afraid, gone over the line into some disregard for the legal and constitutional ways we do business in this country. For example, the warrantless wiretapping and eavesdropping. President appears to think the best defense for those practices is a good offense, so he's aggressively defending this, and as far as I can tell, he's basically claiming a kind of plenary power, that as commander-in-chief, he can do whatever he thinks is necessary.
That is the underlying legal theory at all levels of the government's legal apparatus. You read the most recent report about in the New Yorker about the Guantanamo and the justification, the legal justification coming from the Department of Defense lawyers about that essentially is the president is commander-in-chief and he can do almost everything, whether it violates the law or not, is the theme. And there are exceptions and they're reasonable. I mean, you've got lawyers who are defending it and maybe not willing to go all the way, but that is a theme that runs through everything. I guess the question for you is, that in times when people really believe that they're under threat, they're willing to allow the chief executive, they're willing to tilt towards more absolute power if they believe that absolute power is necessary to protect them.
Well, and there's no question that terrorism and the era of terrorism poses new challenges. Nobody's going to challenge that, or nobody should challenge it, and we need to do some new kinds of surveillance that are adapted to new ways of communicating. And the defensible portions of the Patriot Act were about that. And then this statute that the president supposedly is operating under, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, provides for the president to go to this special court and to get the warrants that he needs to undertake, in some cases, quite extraordinary surveillance. But it does say that that he goes to the court. And there's nothing in the congressional debate on that, or for that matter, on going after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, the resolution that authorized that. There's nothing to suggest that all constraints were being lifted, that the president was to be a power unto himself. And after all, the president's claiming that this is a kind of open-ended war on terrorism. It kind of lasts forever, doesn't it? And so these powers have no end.
So a 1984 war is peace kind of argument.
I've come to the conclusion that since Congress isn't doing its job on this, there should have been vigorous oversight on this, and the House isn't inclined to do oversight on this more than anything else. Senator Spector may yet do some serious work, but certainly nothing in the House. So I, at the time of my announcement this week, I said, I've come to the conclusion, and I don't do this lightly, but I've come to the conclusion that we really do need to call for a special counsel to look at the facts of the matter here and determine the legality of what the president's done. I have no illusions that that's going to happen.
Why do you do it? I do it
because I think, number one, it's the kind of move that is called for under the circumstances, and that that I can justify in terms of the precedents and the kind of reasons that one appoints a special counsel. And as I said, I don't appoint a special counsel or say we should at the drop of a hat. There are special circumstances, and I think this is this qualifies. So I think it's a sound case, and I also think it has some potential then for getting wider support in the Congress and in the public, and beginning to put some pressure on our Republican colleagues and on the president himself to cease and desist in unlawful behavior. And if he needs to request a change in the law so that he can do what he feels he needs to do, then he can come to the Congress and get the authority he wants.
Well, David Price, let's talk. That's really interesting. And I want to ask you some more questions about that and other matters that you'll be facing as you go back to Washington now, and as you will go back if the voters of this district return you in November. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Tony Hall, real estate broker at Tony Hall & Associates. When it comes time to sell your home, the old saying, you only have one chance to make a good first impression, applies to how your home will show to prospective buyers. So preparing your home for the market is important, although it can be a confusing notion. I have a reputation for eliminating the confusion by giving good advice to my clients as they prepare their homes for sale. I am careful to suggest any improvements that will enhance the home's marketing potential. For example, some painting may need to be done, or mulching and pruning in the yard, or the windows may need washing. My 20 years of experience can determine this. When the time comes to sell your home, you deserve this extra level of professional service offered by Tony Hall & Associates. Call us at 933-8500 or contact us on the internet at TonyHallAssociates.com. At Tony Hall & Associates, we don't just list houses, we sell them.
This is Gerald Remoyne, General Manager of Performance Auto Mall. Over the years, you've heard me talk about how proud we are to be a sponsor of WCHL's Village Pride Awards and about the great work we do in our sales and service departments. But nobody can describe our passion and commitment better than our employees. The people at Performance arrive each day committed to a special relationship with you, our neighbor.
My name is Ben Canada. I'm the shop foreman here at Performance. The mission is to fix the car right the first time, every time. We satisfy our customers by giving them a personal touch. They're not just another customer. We know most of them by name. We recognize them when they come in, and I think we have a very good, positive outlook here. I believe that Performance can't be beat.
I couldn't have said it better. Every day, we try to earn the right to be your car dealer as well as your neighbor. And when we say Performance can't be beat, we mean it.
News Talk 1360 WCHL presents D.G. Martin with Who's Talking, Sunday mornings from 8 to noon.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to David Price, a candidate now for Congress, and his job is our representative. We're trying to visit with David to find out a little bit about what motivates him to reapply for this job. And one of those things is the, these are your words, the arrogance of power has got you worried.
Well, there's been a very good example in recent days, and that is the handling of this ports question, where the company, the British company that has managed six of our key ports, has been purchased by a United Arab Emirates company, and presumably our government's giving approval to this without the kind of consultation, without the kind of investigation that one would think would be routine in a case like this. Just another example. I mean, this wouldn't be such an alarming story if it didn't come on the top of of a history of neglect of port security on the one hand, and a kind of arrogant exercise of power on the other. It's just not the way we do business in these country. In this country, there needs to be a required 45-day period of investigation. There needs to be consultation with the leaders of the Congress. There needs to be a justification, not just an announcement that we're doing this, but an anticipation of some of the obvious questions and an attempt to interpret what's going on, as opposed to just this summary judgment. So, yes, it's a pattern with this administration.
Let me interrupt you about this because, and see if you have any sympathy for me. The partisan side of me says I'm glad the guy tripped and made a mistake and he's paying for some of his sins before. But on this particular matter, we ought to not rush to judgment on the particular merits of the matter until we better understand how ports work and whether or not this fits within our overall understanding. And I find myself thinking, well, if I like George Bush better, I wouldn't jump on him so hard. do you have some of those feelings as we evaluate this?
Sure. Sure. Although it is interesting how many Republicans seem to be jumping on, starting with a congresswoman we both know from Charlotte, whose one-sentence letter ends with "Hell no," and has gotten her on the front pages nationally. But no, of course, this is something that is perhaps more complex than meets the eye, and it needs to be looked at very carefully. But it does need to be looked at, and it needs to be looked at in a way that people will then have confidence in how the judgment is being made.
Well, it's interesting to me, and maybe I disclose some of my partisan ideas about this, but it's interesting to me always in politics that where there is a price to be paid for, I would just say for improper ways of doing things, for the arrogance of power, that very often it comes not in the case where it really should. That is where the arrogance of power was most egregious. Because for some reason or other, the public never got excited about it. But then on some matter that, you know, maybe wasn't as important, it fires the public up.
Yeah, I think that's exactly
people,
right.
The people wind up having to pay a price. And you mentioned Congresswoman Sue Myrick's one-sentence letter. She's usually one of the most loyal supporters of the president. But because of this thing where she really knows how to read the public and she – feels it. She feels the wind at her back, and she's willing to go right up against the president. That's an interesting sign for me of what's going to happen in the next few months.
Yeah, and I think what you say is good advice. So one should reserve judgment, but one should insist. One should insist that we have this thoroughly examined in a way that can give us the confidence that our security is being protected. And as I said earlier, I really don't think that there'd be quite this outcry if there was a history of more concern about port security. In fact, it's been something we've hammered on for at least 2 years, that this is a seriously underestimated threat. And if there wasn't this history of kind of peremptory presidential action. You say picking the most serious instances is important. I think that's right. And like you say, the public doesn't always necessarily get most exercised over the most serious instances. But I do think in this case of eavesdropping and warrantless wiretapping, that number one, that is serious. That is serious business. There is a bipartisan Congressional Research Service report, which I find very convincing, which suggests this is way over the line. And it is also exercising the public. Mm-hmm. So I do think here there's a very serious issue we need to come to grips with. And I do think probably we've reached the point where a special counsel would be the preferred course.
Well, David, let me push you on this, because if the Democrats were in charge of the House and the Senate, let's say in the House, is the action that we already know the facts on many of these cases, and they're with an investigation that would lead you where it looks like it would lead you. Are these activities of the executive, do they represent activities that could be an impeachment offense if you had a partisan majority in the House? Could you impeach the president on these facts as you know them, or as they might turn out to be?
Well, I can't make that judgment right now.
I think
we're in dangerous territory, though. with this and the Valerie Plame outing matter, too. If it turns out Dick Cheney actually ordered that, then there's going to be some very serious concerns about Dick Cheney's future. If he ordered his subordinates, Scooter Libby and the others, to actually reveal the identity of a secret agent. I'm not saying he did, but we don't know where that investigation is going. In the case of this warrantless wiretapping, these are legal and constitutional matters of the greatest importance. Historically, they've been dealt with. The things of this sort have been dealt with in various ways. There are instances where the perpetrator simply ceased and desisted from the behavior. There might be statutory adjustments that would be possible. But the first step is to understand the extent of the offense and its legality. And that's what I think, if Democrats were in control, I hope that's the first thing we'd go after.
I'm asking you.
We'd want to have hearings that explored that.
Jump
very
over
fully.
Some hurdles, but and I'm not asking you to make a final judgment about it, but wouldn't you agree that based on what we know now, it's possible that if you didn't have a partisan majority on the Republican side, but had an objective group in the Democratic House, that these could turn out to be impeachable offenses? Possibly. Okay.
Well, it's not.
I won't push you.
No, I don't mind being pushed. If you're talking about the historic grounds for talking impeachment, then there's surely something to what you say. But whether you think that is the kind of territory we're operating in here, or whether you think that other remedies are more likely or more desirable, seems to me the first step is to understand what's going on.
Yep.
And to have some exploration of the legal and constitutional status of what's going on. And congressional hearings can sometimes achieve that. But that's not going to happen with the folks in charge right now. So that's what makes me, with some reluctance, turn to the special counsel idea. And it's an idea that seems to be getting increasing attention. Vice President Gore, for example, in a very powerful speech a couple of weeks ago, said that that's the conclusion he's come to. So I'm going to push the idea. I have no illusions that the president would do this in a million years. But I do think it's an idea that has some persuasive power with the American public and with colleagues in Congress.
We'll watch it. We need to take a break. I've got 1,000 things to talk about before we finish, but we've just got a little bit of time. Congressman David Price, and I'll be right back.
WCHL 1360, time now for a biography for radio with Jack Perkins, brought to you locally by the Cedars and East-West Partners community.
It was a most unusual marriage. She was pious and prudish. He was crude and debauched. His story next on Biography for Radio.
In the game of life, your credit score can make all the difference in the world.
The Smith family is going for a home loan. The referees are reviewing their credit score.
Wouldn't you like to know your credit score before you apply for credit? Now you can. Log on to freecreditreport.com and get your credit score and credit report online for free.
Upon further review, the loan is approved.
Get your free credit report and score with enrollment and triple advantage at freecreditreport.com. That's freecreditreport.com.
The French nobleman had a terrible reputation. Though charming and well-bred, he was known for corrupting young ladies. His father, desperate to be rid of his arrogant son, arranged a marriage to a plain girl with a very big dowry. Surprisingly, the couple became devoted to each other. They moved to a remote castle and hired 6 pretty teenagers, supposedly as maids. Soon, the villagers were whispering stories about whippings, orgies, and sodomy. Yet the aristocrat's wife stood by him, referring to him fondly as my good little boy. Finally, the police raided the castle. The nobleman escaped and spent years on the run. But his mother-in-law had him tracked, and in 1777, he was thrown in jail. There, he wrote the erotic fantasies Justine and Juliet, both of which made him famous and notorious. For years, it was thought his book, The 120 Days of Sodom, was lost in the French Revolution. But the script was later found rammed into a bedpost. In the end, an insane asylum was the last home of the man whose name is now used to define the enjoyment of cruelty, the Marquis de Sade. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by The Cedars of Chapel Hill, an East-West Partners community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at The Cedars of Chapel Hill.
You can hear D.G. Martin with a replay of Who's Talking from the whole week, Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360. WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. David Price, our congressman, and now as a part of the big news, he's a candidate again to run for Congress. David, there's so many things that interest me about your work. First of all, I know how hard it is and all the balls you have to keep juggling. One of the most difficult things that I see in your work, you've been, as you mentioned earlier, your work on the Appropriations Committee has been good for this district, notwithstanding the fact that your party is not in the majority party and that in many cases you're frozen out of the decision-making process. There's a lot of criticism about the appropriations process now in the, what do you call it, the earmarks or the all of you, every representative is sort of obligated to try to go get special attention for his or her district. And what, how does this work? And are you worried like others are about the appropriation process, or is it basically in pretty good shape?
No, I don't think it's in good shape. But I might describe the problems a little differently than some would. The basic problem we're dealing with in our federal budget right now is that we're getting what you might call the worst of both worlds. We're getting huge deficits. We're looking in this next year with the president's budget at a deficit spending total of $423 billion. And the president's budget, if you look at it carefully, lowballs the Iraq war expenses. It doesn't take into account what it might take to fix the alternative minimum tax so that millions of middle-class people aren't paying it and so forth. So it's a deceptive budget, and even at that, it's $423 billion in the red. So we're going over the cliff fiscally, and yet you ask yourself, are we getting the money we need for our critical domestic needs? And the answer there is no. Whether it's highways or research or public education or so many other things. So we have an alternative Democratic budget that achieves balance sooner and that at the same time is more generous towards some of our domestic needs. And I'll, of course, be pushing for that alternative. But anyway, that's the context. And within the context, we're trying to pass appropriations bills. And these appropriations bills on the domestic side are inadequate. And so one way to understand earmarks, at least the kind of earmarks I seek, is that we're compensating for an absence of funding for things that communities ought to be able to access and are no longer able to. Let's just take an example. Community X here in the 4th District, their police department needs to upgrade their communications equipment so they can talk to other responders more adequately and access the state patrol or whatever, you know. So the grants in the Justice Department that they used to be able to go after during the Clinton administration and even earlier Republican administrations, so the Bush administration has dried up that funding. So this police department comes to me and says, can you write into the bill an earmark, a specific appropriation for us to do this? And I say to them, yes, I will try, because I think this is needed. It's justified. Is this the ideal way to do it? No. I'm compensating in this case for an absence of support from this administration for so much that we need to do domestically. I would put support for achievement gap type programs over in Durham in that same category. Wouldn't it be better if an education grant was available for an after school program? But no. So I try to get an earmark. So often we're compensating for shortfalls elsewhere.
All that makes sense to me. I think the thing that seems to me to be a real tough challenge is that in the middle of all this partisanship, in order for you to have any leeway to get these kinds of earmarks, appropriate earmarks for your district, you can't be spitting in the face of your chairman, of your majority chairman or your majority colleagues on the Appropriations Committee. Can you, or how does that work? I mean, you've got to develop some sort of collegial working relationship.
That's right. And that's fortunately, the partisanship that has infected so much of the House of Representatives in particular has not totally infected the Appropriations Committee. So
let me just put it.
So we do operate cooperatively.
If you were critical, you'd say, okay, Mr. Chairman, I won't object too strongly to your earmarks if you let me have some of mine. I mean, has to be part of the.
Well, the system certainly depends on a sense of of responsibility on the part of the members, and when somebody abuses their authority, like one of the transportation chairmen did in getting money for this bridge to nowhere.
Right.
I mean, that not only is wasteful and irresponsible, but it also casts a pall on everybody, and it's the sort of thing that we all try not to be put on the defensive about, because most of what we do, I think, is justifiable, and we need to make sure that it's justifiable.
Thank you for it's tough to understand. That helps a lot. But we're coming to the end, and I wanted to save just a minute or two to let you sort of close and tell us why we should consider voting for you again for Congress.
Oh my, you're looking for the stump speech, which I'm going to have to.
I'm looking for the 30-second version.
Well, I appreciate the chance to talk with you today and to just explore a lot of these things. I say in my statement announcing for candidacy that I cooperate when I can and I resist when I must. And maybe that's a way to sum up what I've said today. There are areas of cooperation, including what we need to do in funding the priorities of this state, that I will work the very best I can, even from a minority position, to deliver. But there's a lot to resist these days in terms of the budget going over the cliff, our diplomacy melting down around the world, a prescription drug benefit, which we didn't even get into, which is just an awful thing for our senior citizens and needs to be changed. There's a lot to resist. There's a lot to aspire to do better with, and I promise to do that as well.
Well, thank you for that, and also thanks for taking time to visit with us. Come back soon, and thanks for all you're doing, David Price. Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
This is Roy Williams. Playing good defense may be the hardest part of the game, but making a layup, if you do it right, should be easy. As easy as hopping on a local bus for a free ride to every part of town and campus. And taking the bus really is a layup for everybody. We keep cars off the road, reducing traffic and pollution. We reduce the number of required parking spaces. And selfishly, of course, we save money. Come ride with the smart people. Take a free ride at Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and UNC. The buses are for everyone, and the buses here are free.
Do you have anxiety about going to the dentist? At Dr. Robinson's office, we know that it is very common for people to feel nervous about dental work. In fact, many people will put off going to the dentist because they are afraid. But having regular dental cleanings and oral exams is part of your body's overall health. If you are the type of person that avoids the dentist because of anxiety, you could be a candidate for sedation dentistry. For more information about sedation dentistry or to schedule your appointment with Dr. Teresa Robinson, please call 1-800-NEW-GRIN.
News Talk 1360 WCHL presents What You're Saying on Campus.
This is Courtney Moore of the 1360 WCHL Community Crew. We all know that the UNC Tar Heels are getting ready to take on their heated rival, the Duke Blue Devils. Ooh. This Saturday over in Cameron Indoor. I'm on campus asking something that y'all may not know. How do you spell Coach K's name?
Ashley Butler, Sr. K-S-C-H-E-S-H-E-S-K-Y.
My name is Misty. I'm a junior. K-R-Y-Z. And a Y at the end. Some more letters, but I don't know.
This is Courtney Moore of the 1360 WCHL Community Crew, and the correct spelling is KRZYZEWSKI. That's what you're saying on campus.
At home, at work, in the car. News Talk 1360, WCHL, Chapel Hill.